Look, Discussions of Truth is free, it's independent, it's uncensored, and it's never edited. Why I use Anchor.fm? Because podcasting today is the new medium for media. Like Ray McGovern said, former CIA agent, almost 3 decades in the agency. He said, Ian, what you're doing today is the last frontier. And that's why you, listening to this, yes, you, need to start a podcast now. Anchor is a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing your podcast. Best of all, it's 100% free and ridiculously easy to use. And now, Anchor can match you with great sponsors who want to advertise on your podcast. That means you can get paid to podcast right away. In fact, that's what I'm doing right now by reading this ad. Go to anchor.fm/start. Get the word out, because your word is the word. StopMassMedia.com. Discussions of Truth. I am Ian Trottier. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Wednesday's edition, as always. This is Discussions of Truth. I am your host, Ian Hamilton Trottier, and I want to, you know, you need to have a good producer, right, to put off a great show. And Proctor 17, they do video work here locally to South Florida and Miami. And evidently they're handy in other ways as well, because I give mucho kudos to Proctor 17 to getting this show up and running today. They produce Discussions of Truth. Again, I'm your host, Ian Hamilton Trottier. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Instagram. Go to my website. It's Ian Trottier. That's IanTrottier.com. Check out my guest list. They are impressive. Impressive. Last week, we were very fortunate to be graced by the presence on air, former managing director of Goldman Sachs. Nomi was in London the week prior to being on our program, talking about central banking, because that's what she does. And she's written a pretty incredible book, Collusion: How Central Bankers Rigged the World. She's a former Bear Stearns managing director, and she was also a senior strategist at Lehman Brothers. I quit Wall Street, Nomi says, and decided that it was time to talk more about what was going on inside it, as it had changed. It had become far more sinister and far more dangerous. That is not to be taken lightly. Well, prior to Nomi, we had Ray McGovern on the program. And Ray McGovern spent 27 years in the CIA. He's quoted as saying, basically, Ian, what you're doing is essentially the last frontier, because we're not looking at a military-industrial complex anymore. We are now looking at a military-industrial-congressional media complex. He says, I'm basically the last hope. And if I'm the last hope, that means you, who's listening, is the last hope. Because you can, just like I am, give a platform for people who really know what's going on in Washington and central banks to have their voice heard. Because it doesn't go very far on mainstream media. So today, we're going to bring on Wolf Richter. And he's going to let us know what's going on economically and financially from his viewpoint in the United States. Stuff you're not going to get on when you turn on Fox Business. Stuff you're not going to get when you turn on CNN. Stuff you're not going to get on MSNBC. So it's up to us. It's up to every individual American who's not endorsed by super PACs, who's not bought out by big corporations, to talk about what's going on, to dig and find the truth. That means searching through people, professors, researchers, whatever it may be, at universities that know what's going on, apart from universities. But dig, 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 and dig to figure out what is going on. Because, like Noam Chomsky has recently said, Donald Trump, he's nothing more than a distraction to you. He's meant to divide you, to infuriate you. Okay? That is what he is. He's the apprentice. Okay, he fires people. He's making a mockery. Not necessarily that he's making a mockery, because it's not him. It's the people that are pulling his strings, i.e. central bankers, that make all Americans and the U.S. Constitution look like buffoons. Absolute buffoons. So, next week, it'll happen to be July 4th. Happy Independence Day to the United States of America. I'm a very patriotic person. I love this country. Absolutely love this country. Got a British mother. I have no desire to be British. Okay? A Scottish grandfather. No desire to be Scottish. I was born in the United States, and I love this country. But I want to make sure that its constitution stays intact. And it's not going to stay that way unless you and I keep raising our voices. Well, if you're not, you should be. So, Robert Bridge. He's an American investigative journalist living in Moscow. A native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, his book, Midnight in the American Empire, will be topic of discussion next week for July 4th, Independence Day. Apart from that, okay, call me whatever you may like. Talking Points Memo certainly had some harsh words to say about me as I interviewed Senator Chris McDaniel. Okay? I don't care. Free speech, right? What did they say? Words can hurt. Words, excuse me. What's that saying? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Okay, yeah. You say whatever you want. Okay, open your mouth. Let the air. You know, let that flute roll. I don't care what you say. But a guy like a Richard Gage, who's a well-respected member of the American Institute of Architects, he's got a big problem with the investigation that turned on for. I'm gonna go back down this road. I'm gonna go back down this road because I can. Because I can. 9/11. Okay? And he's got well over 2,000 other well-credentialed architects and engineers that also have a problem with that report. Okay? And so I'm bringing him onto this program to educate you about what he's discovered. About what may have happened alternatively 9/11. Did two airplanes fly into those buildings? Absolutely. Did 3,000 people lose their lives? Absolutely. Does it seem like Al-Qaeda engineered the most masterful attack on any country in the history of mankind? Yes, quite possibly. That is what seems to have happened. Were there other people supporting them, financing any of them? Who knows? That's a good question, right? Was thermite used as demolition to bring down those towers? Did Al-Qaeda, did they go in days before and plant bombs? You know, thermite, nuclear explosive demolition, explosive devices? I don't know. But Richard Gage, who's been an architect for 3 decades, he seems to think so.
So, you know what? I'm going to bring him on the program. And I want to hear what he has to say. Because I can.
Okay? I don't take sides. All I know is I love this country, but there's, you know, there's things that are certainly awry. And I want to make sure people that have voices that question the government, the elected people that question them, I want to make sure they have that freedom to do so. La Trastienda de Trump is going to be a look at Trump behind the scenes from Daniel Estulin. And then we're going to bring in August. Well, midway through August, we're going to host Gretchen Peters. Okay. And she's another investigative reporter. Her book, Seeds of Terror, she's going to go into Afghanistan. Because, by the way, guys, we've been in Afghanistan for now, close to 2 decades, by the way. Right? So what's that all about? I'm going to cut to a break. I'm going to be back on program. Wolf Richter of WolfStreet.com, San Francisco, California. I'm out of Miami, and the Wynwood Radio, you are tuned in. Ian Trottier, I'm your host, weekly, Wednesdays, 5 o'clock, Discussions of Truth, Proctors 17. Muchos kudos to Proctors 17. They are spectacular. I will be right back, and we'll talk Wolf Street.
Can you hear me?
With the Wix logo.
Okay, little master puppets, welcome home, Sanitarium. We have online with us Wolf Richter. Wolf, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Fantastic, sir. Thank you for your versatility. And we are an independent radio program, and there's always a few little tweaks and turns. Wolf, would you do listeners a favor and quickly introduce yourself? I told them about Wolf Street, but go ahead and please introduce yourself.
Well, thanks for having me. My website is wolfstreet.com. I put everything on there. It is free all the time, and we discuss economics, finance, and business issues, and we stay out of politics, so that's what we do. My background has been in business for decades now, and so this is my new gig. I have a small company, a media company that does this.
That's fantastic, and I understand you you get about 1 million hits to Wolf Street each month. Is that about right?
That's about right, yeah.
And you're in a city that I admire personally. I like that city quite a bit. It's San Francisco. You're in San Francisco.
I'm in San Francisco. I'm just a few blocks away from the bay, and I go swimming in the bay almost every day. So I just got back a couple hours ago.
Fantastic. Do you have to wear? Do you go without a wetsuit?
Yeah, I belong to a swim club, and we do it without a wetsuit throughout the winter, even when the temperature drops below 50 degrees, and you kind of get used to that, but it does shake you up a little bit.
Okay, so your blood runs pretty quickly through your veins, I'd imagine. Wolf, okay, so take us through. When did you start Wolf Street, and what inspired you to start it?
Well, originally I had another website called Testosterone Pit, and essentially doing the same thing, but the name, you know, it was so awful in terms of media censure that ISPs would block it and I wouldn't get any good ads on it and that kind of thing. So I had to change the name. But originally started that in 2011, and in 2014 I switched over to Wolf Street, and it's been going great ever since. The reason why I started the original site is because my wife got tired of listening to me griping about the Fed and all the things that were going on, and I decided I needed to get a larger audience than that.
You needed a bigger outlet than just your wife. So go ahead, gripe about the Fed. What's going on with the Fed?
Oh, well,
give it your best shot. Give it your left hook.
Yeah, and back in 2011, you know, they were doing QE, and which was an infuriating thing to do, because they defined what that was supposed to do. Ben Bernanke defined it in an editorial in the Washington Post. It was supposed to create the wealth effect, quote unquote, which means that the asset holders would get wealthier, and they would then start spending more money, and that would help the economy. That was the theory. The result is that assets have gotten a lot more expensive, including housing. Now we have a housing crisis in San Francisco and in many other cities, where people who make their money out of labor can no longer afford to rent or buy homes. And that's the side effect of inflating asset prices. Unless you inflate wages along with it, you know, it doesn't work. You've got one class, the asset holders, that got incredibly wealthy during this process, and you've got another class of people, a much larger class of people who make their money with the sweat of their brow. You know, they're dependent on their wages, and these asset prices move further and further out of reach. And housing is one thing, but it includes things like stock portfolios, bond portfolios, and retirement funds. Now you're using labor dollars that have been repressed for a long time to buy these inflated asset prices. And that's the thing that the Fed has done. It has shifted wealth, future wealth and current wealth from labor to asset holders. And I think this was a move that will, when we look back years from now, that will be considered horrendous.
And whose decision has that basically been to do that?
Well, Ben Bernanke was obviously the man in charge of the Fed at the time, and there were other people involved in it, and they voted on it, and so there's a number of people. There was probably a lot of pressure from big asset holders to do exactly that. Warren Buffett was probably the single biggest beneficiary in the world of these policies, because he has a financial and insurance empire, and it was collapsing, and he got an incredible deal. Yeah, he got bailed out, and not like that he would have lost everything, but he might have been $20 billion poorer, and instead now we have people who work for a living who can no longer buy the things they need to buy. And the top 10%, top 20%, top 30%, they have done really well in this recovery. And everybody acknowledges that. That's been very good for them. They've not only had jobs that started paying more, but they've also seen their wealth go up in terms of asset prices. So there's a lot of credit being taken for that. And they say, we fixed the economy, we fixed the housing market, we got everything reflated, and that is true for a certain part of the population, and I can definitely see that. And I've benefited from it too. It's not like there weren't people that benefited from it, but it just I think it did a really terrible job on the structure of the economy.
So, you mentioned a housing crisis. I believe that's what you said, in San Francisco. There's a number of high-rise condominiums being built in San Francisco. Is that right?
That's correct. And San Francisco is a small place. So when you look at the city, exactly. I mean, you can walk across it in a couple of hours in every direction. And it's not a big city like Dallas or Houston or even, a place like Seattle. So the city itself is small, and it has had a huge housing boom. And these are all multifamily. There's no single family homes being built in San Francisco forever. I mean, that stopped a long time ago. So they took industrial space, essentially warehouse district. And there's a lot more space available in San Francisco. We have a lot of space that has nuclear contamination from the Cold War, the old Navy shipyards, for example. I mean, that's all going to get built on. But they built tower after tower after tower. And these are apartment buildings and condo buildings. And, there is no housing shortage in San Francisco whatsoever. There's a shortage of affordable housing, but there's vacant apartments, condos are being offered for sale. There's tons of stuff going on in terms of availability. It's just people can't afford it.
So what's driving those kind of luxury? Is there a market for that? Because for the, kind of the dot-com millionaires, or not nearly dot-com, but the current kind of internet internet engineers, is that what's driving that need for market for high-end condos in San Francisco?
There is a small market for it. Yeah, it's a small market. I mean, the median condo in is $1.2 million. And so that's like a two-bedroom and may not have a garage, you know, and it's not anything fancy. If you go to something fancier, you know, it goes up very quickly. And, you know, you can spend $10 million on a condo in San Francisco without breaking a sweat. And so who can afford a $1.2 million condo? And you have to have two very good incomes to make that work. So this is the median condo, and it requires a household income that is way, way above median. Even in San Francisco, I mean, the median income in San Francisco is pretty high. It's like $93,000 median household income, and usually comprising of, you know, more than one earner. And so that's much higher than in the nation. The average is like 55,000 across the United States. But even with a much higher median household income, these people cannot afford a median condo. You know, so they can't afford hardly anything. You know, so it that's what's called a housing crisis, where we have teachers who no longer can afford to live in the city where they teach. And rent's the same thing. So if you can't afford a condo while you're trying to rent, and the median rents in San Francisco for like a one bedroom is close to $3,000. You know, so you're spending, you know, 70% or so of your teacher's salary just on an apartment.
So in Miami, there's an incredible boom in construction here. I've noticed this just within the past two, and there's these luxury condos. I don't know if there's any parallel to kind of what you're experiencing in San Francisco. I don't know if there's that kind of boom for luxury condos in other cities. I believe I've heard some of it's going on in Los Angeles. Frankly, I don't know what's driving that growth locally in Miami. Go ahead.
You're correct. I mean, Miami has an enormous condo boom, condo and apartment boom. The biggest one in the country is in Seattle. And that's the epicenter of overbuilding right now. And I just got some data in, and I'm going to look at it and write about it here in the next day or two. And and I've been doing that in the past. I mean, that Seattle is a much bigger market than San Francisco. And in Miami, it's along the waterfront that you have the construction boom of high rises. And Seattle is just all over the place. And crane counting has become a passion, and vacancy rates in apartments are now huge in these high-rise towers in downtown Seattle. It's 25% vacancy rate. I mean, they're facing some major problems there. And you know, your question was, where does this come from? And you know, this is what you get into when you have extraordinarily low interest rates, when money is really cheap, and the costs sort of disappear and distort decision making, and you know, everybody is building high end because that's how you, as a developer, that's how you hope to make money, because you have bigger profit margins, you know, and you can get more money for these units if there's a market for them. And there was a big market. I mean, there was a sufficient market for it for some of it. And now, you know, you have investors plowing. And in Miami Beach, you know, this is, in Miami in general, this is a very interesting phenomenon that's going on in other cities too, but down there in particular, because you have so much foreign money coming in there. Investors buy these condos in the pre-construction phase, and they flip them. They try to flip them.
Uh-huh.
As either during the construction process or when they're completed, and you know, you can't get a mortgage on an unfinished condo, so they have lenders that work with them. It's a whole industry that grew up around that, and so you have a lot of this flipping going on. And when these investors, so they're no longer developer owned, they're now investor owned, even though the developer is still building the building, and it's a way of funding the development. And that, you know, has run into trouble too, because now there's fear of those flippers jumping in the market. Those that have jumped in have trouble selling the units. There are a lot of towers that are mostly vacant. and in terms of people living there. So this is a situation where we don't really know what's going on until it falls apart, and suddenly the bank starts foreclosing on these condos, and it turns out nobody wants to buy them, nobody's living in them, and there's really not a whole lot they can do with them. And this is a particular issue in Miami, and it's funding some of those construction surges, but I can't. Yeah, even in Miami, I can't see how this will go on forever.
Yeah, I can't see it. I can't see it either. Wolf, let's go back to the Federal Reserve, and it seems like that may have been kind of what initially got you revved your engines to start Wolf Street. I don't know. Are you familiar with Nomi Prinz by chance?
Yeah, somewhat.
Okay, so yeah, she was on the program last week, and she spoke about your former Goldman Sachs managing director, and she spoke about the central banks. What, in your opinion, Wolf, you seem to be pretty bright, up to date with economics and that sort of thing. You kind of understand on a national scale, at least. Haven't talked to you about international scale. In your opinion, what should the Federal Reserve be? For instance, it's private, right? It's totally private. They close their doors, and should it be more public? What do you feel?
Well, the Federal Reserve is a hybrid institution. So a big part is private, as you said. So all the Federal Reserve banks, there are 12 of them, they're private institutions. So the New York Fed, the San Francisco Fed, and those institutions are privately owned banks. They're owned by the biggest financial institutions in the districts. And those institutions vote for the management. Yeah, so they're completely private institutions. The Federal Reserve also has the Board of Governors, and the Board of Governors, the head of that is Jerome Powell, and these are all federal employees. They're appointed. Jerome Powell was appointed by the president and affirmed by the Senate, and so they're the federal entity of the Federal Reserve, and it's a small group of people, but they're employees of the federal government, and they're appointed by the president, and so it's a hybrid situation. And when it comes to voting, all the governors on the Board of Governors vote, and then on a rotating basis, the heads of the privately owned regional Federal Reserve banks vote. So there's a majority of federal employees that decide the interest rate decisions, and there's a minority of privately of the heads of these privately run Federal Reserve banks. And I'm really leery about these kinds of central banks that are too close to the government. And for example, in Argentina, the central bank is essentially a department of the Ministry of Finance. And it was nationalized back in the 1930s, I think. And its main function is to fund government spending, essentially. And in the process, they have completely destroyed the peso. Wow. And the peso used to be worth a dollar in 2001, and it's now worth 3 or 4 cents.
Oh, boy.
And the dollar has lost about 95% of its value, too, but that happened since the Fed came into existence since 1913. So it's been 105 years, and Argentina accomplished the same thing in just a few years. The peso is down like about 30% just this year. And so they have a free fall going on. They have a collapsing currency, and they continue to fund government operations by essentially just printing money. And they've now been locked out of essentially borrowing in hard currency. They can't borrow in pesos long term because nobody wants to buy that crap and be exposed to inflation is 25%+. So this is what a central bank can do to the currency if it is part of the government. And And that's what I'm leery about. You know, I don't want the central bank to do the bidding of Congress. You know, if politicians are just, you know, they're really interested in buying votes. And so if you get the free money from the biggest money printer out there, then why not? You know, it's going to look good for a little while. At the same time, long term, it's a disastrous thing. Now, we all have fiat currencies now in the entire world, so they have to be managed very carefully, and they're very easy to destroy. They're based on trust. If you destroy that trust, it's gone forever. And if you that's the trust of their own people. So if Americans lose trust in the dollar, you can kiss the dollar goodbye. You know, I mean, and the world, the global community also needs to trust the dollar. You know, you look at the yen, the Japanese yen, the Japanese love their currency. They trust it totally. And despite what the government is doing, the enormous amount that it's borrowing, and despite the fact that the Central Bank of Japan is monetizing a big part of that debt now, the Japanese people and the world community, they trust the yen, and so it has held up extremely well, despite all these things, you know. And when a country like Argentina can't build that trust in its currency, it goes to heck, you know. And that's the big fear I have. And the Fed needs to, you know, we have the Fed, we live with it, and it doesn't matter how I wail and gnash my teeth about it, you know. That's the reality. And I think the Fed needs to manage the dollar so that it won't suffer the fate of the Argentine peso.
And it maintains consumer confidence. Wolf, it seems like you might be German, and maybe you want to say a few things about Deutsche Bank.
Oh yeah. As first things first, you know, there is no way that Deutsche Bank will be allowed to collapse in a disorderly fashion. And a lot of people are saying that may happen, but the government of Germany is just not going to let that happen. And they didn't in the past, and they won't in the future. You know, during the financial crisis, they bailed out the second largest bank of Germany, Commerzbank, and they supported Deutsche Bank. And they will continue to do that. I mean, the Deutsche Bank is weighs so heavily in the German economy, in the real economy, you know, in the industrial economy of Germany. It is so important that there can be no disorderly collapse of that bank. So that won't happen. At the same time, that bank has had. Yeah, it used to be just a fairly conservative big industrial bank in Germany. It had a big retail branch organization, you know, and it was conservatively run. And then somewhere along the line, the Wall Street virus got into it, and they decided we are going to become a big global bank and get into derivatives and all these other sexy things. And now, you know, the bank has had nothing but trouble for years, and it's been losing money 3 years in a row. I mean, it's full exposure to derivatives and other things not even known. I look at it. Its shares and its bonds, especially the cocoa bonds, they were set up as capital, and they're designed to be bailed in when the bank gets in trouble. And those things have been going down again. So investors are losing confidence in the bank. And so when Deutsche Bank gets in trouble, my prediction is that shareholders will take a big hit, and these cocoa bond holders will take a big hit. That's planned, you know. They will take that before shareholders will, and then that may be all of the damage investors will have to take, and then the German government will step in and more or less in an orderly fashion take care of the rest. I mean, there's a consensus in Germany that Deutsche Bank is way too big to fail for the German economy. Not, I mean, it's not a Wall Street thing. It's an industrial economy thing, and you know, all the major industrial companies in Germany do business with Deutsche Bank, and so it's a utility for Germany, Uggie. You know, it's like electricity; it has to be there. You can't turn it off, and so And that will probably be beneficial for the world economy too, because if he allowed a huge bank like Deutsche Bank with so much international business and so interwoven into other banks to blow up in a disorderly fashion, you know, you would have another mega financial crisis on your hands. And so it's okay if the German taxpayer, I'm not one of them, you know, if they get to bail out Deutsche Bank. I've had my share of bailouts here in the United States, so I've paid for my share.
Okay, so let's talk about a little bit of a bailout, like the biggest bailout that maybe Americans should be concerned about. Should there be concern about the rapidly growing amount of debt that this country has?
Yeah, and there's two things. One, the United States, by definition, cannot go bankrupt. So that fear is off the table because, you know, we can print our money, and so if we can't legitimately pay back the debt, we'll just print some money, and that's, yeah, the it's not the government that's doing it, it's the Federal Reserve that would be doing it, right. And the Federal Reserve is the lender of last resort to the government, so it can't hand the government the money, but, you know, as QE has shown, it can be there as a buyer for that debt, and it will always be there. So there is no way that the United States can go bankrupt. Like Argentina didn't default on its peso bonds, it defaulted on its foreign currency bonds. And the United States doesn't have any foreign currency bonds. You know, even Argentina made good on its peso bonds, you know, because they just collapsed in value. But what happens in the United States if a problem occurs is that instead of a debt crisis, Greece had a debt crisis. Now, right. Argentina had a debt crisis because they don't control their own currency. But instead of a debt crisis, we may have a currency crisis. And that will be the risk of this debt, that the world and Americans lose confidence in the dollar, and that we get too much inflation, and we get people trying to get out of dollar denominated investments, and we get all kinds of issues surrounding that, and that will be the hallmark of a currency crisis. Currency crises are in many ways more democratic. A debt crisis, what Argentina went through and what Greece went through, the government no longer has the money to spend money. And so what you will see is that the poorest people will get hit the hardest. You know, the people in the United States would be people on welfare, it would be pensioners, it would be disability recipients, you know. The government would not be able to pay them anymore, and the wealthy people would be okay. You know, they've got the money elsewhere, and they'd be fine, and that's what happened in Greece. This is not happening in the United States. So if we have a currency crisis, it will impact everybody and anybody that owns dollar-denominated assets, and particularly financial assets. So it's, in that sense, it's a lot more democratic. It will also impact labor because generally, wages don't rise quite as fast as the value of the currency collapses during a currency crisis. So, I mean, it will spread around. It's miserable and it's painful. But even Warren Buffett won't be able to escape it. And so that's the good thing, because now you have the asset holders are really worried about that kind of crisis. Yeah, they wouldn't be worried about a debt crisis. They're worried about a currency crisis because they're. Yeah, the dollar-denominated assets would collapse in value, in purchasing power, you know. And so, if you have a bond portfolio that's worth $1 billion, it will still be worth $1 billion, but it can buy only half as much at the end of it. And so that is a real fear. And so there's a lot of big money behind the Fed now to not allow that to happen. So I'm fairly confident there is a strong impetus. Am I saying something wrong? The police coming after me? I think there's a strong impetus out there among the power brokers and the big capital that steers away from a currency crisis. And, you know, the Fed has been tightening, and I think that's part of it. And the Fed won't back off. And they're a machine now, and they're going gradually, quote-unquote, as they always say. But this rate hike cycle has been going on for 2.5 years. It's very slow. Prior rate hike cycles were over in 2 years. You know, so we're just kind of started in 2.5. So this may go on for 4 or 5 years. And, you know, they're unwinding QE, and they're doing everything they can think of without completely blowing up the markets that would, would reinsert some confidence into the dollar. You know, and that's been happening. The dollar's been rising, and a currency crisis will just wipe everybody out, and everybody with assets. You know, so I think a Fed that is independent from politics will try to avoid that.
Now, what's happening in Houston? Is it Carmageddon? What's going on in the car space there?
Houston. Your listener might not know, but I used to live in Texas, and I used to live in Oklahoma, and I went to college in Texas, and I got my MBA in Austin, and so, as they say, my heart is in Texas to some extent, and so this is close to me, and Houston has gotten hit really bad by the oil bust.
Uh-huh.
And any other... The oil bust hit the oil field workers, and it hit the professionals, the office workers. And the office workers are in Houston. And and what happened in car sales is that they essentially collapsed in Houston, in the Houston metro area. And, going down between 20 and 30% on a year-over-year basis. Now, that is huge. That is financial crisis type collapses. Now, and normally when we talk about a decline in sales year over year, it's 2% or 3% or 8%. 8% is bad. 10% is terrible. In Houston, it was 20 to 30% month after month compared to the prior year. And it was just, it was just terrible. And that started in late 2015, and it really got going in 2016 and towards the end of it in 2017. And then in the spring of 2017, May, the oil was going up in price, and it sort of flattened out, and it stopped dropping. And car sales started to just tick up a little bit, and then there was hope that finally in the auto business. And, I used to run a big Ford dealership for 10 years in my prior life. And so I know what this is like. And I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma at that time, which went through its own oil bust in the 1980s and never really recovered from it. And we lost back in the day, we lost 15% of our jobs, and people left because they couldn't find jobs. Young people left. The restaurants closed. It was just terrible. Houston is much more diversified than Tulsa ever was, so it didn't really hit Houston that hard, but it hit pretty hard. And so when oil prices came back up, there's hope that, okay, so car sales would start ticking up again, and they did. And then Hurricane Harvey hit. And that hit in August, and for a week or so, all car dealers in the area were shut down completely, and then some car dealers started opening up again, and others it took longer. And then there was hope, almost instantly propagated on Wall Street, that the distraction from Harvey would create an enormous quote-unquote replacement demand. And there were some figures thrown around of 600,000 vehicles and those kinds of things. And my own estimates back then were probably less than 300,000. And it turns out that was even too high. And the replacement demand was there. There was an uptick in sales in September, October, November, and December. And then it kind of petered out. And a little bit went into January, and now it's completely gone. And we're back to the same old sales during the oil bust. And this is really a very disconcerting development. After Harvey, the oil prices are now in the 70s, they're sitting close to 70 WTI. And there should have been an increase in that part of the economy. And Houston itself is not doing too badly. Employment is up. The retail overall is up a little bit. The office construction sector has plunged, and yeah, there's vacancy rates in the office sector in Houston are in the 20% range. Yeah, they're the worst in the nation, and they won't recover for years. So they stopped building office buildings, and so all of those people eventually lost their jobs. But then Harvey hit, and so now they're in the residential construction. They're rebuilding homes, and so that sort of balanced out. You know, so the building permits are down just a little bit with commercial construction plunging by like 30% and residential construction surging, and so the difference is just a slight downtick. So the overall economy in Houston is not doing that badly right now, but the car sales are it's just terrible. And used car sales were down 10% year over year too, you know. So, and there's some theories why that is happening. In part, people think that, this whole business of fixing flood damaged cars and returning them to service, that's a big thing. And so there's an industry that's set up around this, now auctions and all kinds of things. A lot of it is legit. I mean, you have a car that would normally cost $15,000 that you can buy for $5,000 and it has a flood title on it, but if it runs okay, why not?
Sure. Right.
And so these sales are taking away sales from that replacement demand. We'll have to see how that works out. But if that's a short term thing, it'll blow over. But if this is a larger problem, then I would be really worried.
Yeah. Well, maybe Tesla car sales are up.
Now, Houston, all of Texas, they're really not into cars. It's SUVs, it's pickups, it's compact SUVs.
Okay.
70% of the vehicles sold in the Houston area were what we consider trucks. So that's pickup trucks, SUVs, compact SUVs, and vans. And only 30% were cars. And Tesla's going to have a hard time. There's some people that love Teslas and they'll buy them and they're anywhere. But in terms of a mass market demand, it's probably not in Texas.
Now, Wolf, I want you to run a little bit for listeners through your outlook of Trump economics. And then lastly, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to address a recent article I think you've put up on Wolf Street, how people turn into debt slaves. You can take both those subjects, you can categorize them separately and hit one and then the other. That'd be awesome.
Okay, so in terms of the economy, there's the good, there's the bad, and there's the ugly. and in the spectrum of the Trump policies that we have right now, every area is fully represented. And I have written about the trade deficit of the United States years ago, and people didn't pay attention, they didn't care. Economists and in the media, they have said that offshoring is a good thing, it makes America stronger. They've said that rising imports means the economy is strong in the United States, so we should encourage this. And, my articles were just poo-pooed. And so along comes Trump, and he essentially agrees with me. And he says, okay, this is a big problem. We run these huge trade deficits. We've been offshoring production. We've been laying off manufacturing workers, and we've been giving them jobs at a McDonald's. And that's not really working out very well for our economy. And that's really true. So I'm really glad he is bringing up the trade deficit, and it needs to be brought up. It is corporate America is the biggest culprit in this. It's not other countries. It's corporate America. Yeah. Nobody forced them to offshore production. That was done out of their own decision. So I don't want to blame China or Germany. And there's plenty of blame to go around. There's an unequal playing field. There are tariffs in China, there are tariffs in Germany. There's industrial policy in Germany that keeps imports out. There are all kinds of issues in China where reciprocity would really go a long way, but that's not happening. China is stealing our intellectual property. If you want to manufacture cars in China, you have to set up a joint venture with a Chinese company and give them your technology. There's all these things going on, but in terms of the imports, and we don't really import a lot of cars from China. There's two models we import, the Buick Envision and the Volvo. But we import a lot of components in the auto industry, for example. And And these components, the American component industry shifted after the financial crisis. It shifted from the U.S. to Mexico and to China. And this was corporate America that is responsible for that shift. It's nothing to do with Mexico or China. These were GM and Ford and other companies took their component branches over to China and to Mexico because there's cheap labor and it made sense for them. And so this caused a surge of imports. And it caused the trade deficit to just balloon. And I'm really glad Trump is putting that on the front burner. Now, I'm not always really excited about how he's going about doing that. But the fact that he did that, I think, is really good. And other presidents have tried a little bit, but they really pussyfooted around the issue. They didn't want to make the Chinese mad, and they didn't want to make the Japanese mad, and they didn't want to make the Germans mad. And they really, really, really didn't want to make corporate America mad. And so they really never got anything done in that respect, and they just let it go. And so now we have a president who doesn't care about making anybody mad, and he's out there with his sledgehammer, and it's causing all kinds of anxieties, and I think a lot of that is good. I hope this gets resolved properly. You know, this can really this can really get out of hand, and it can really go into a trade war. It can go. I mean, this can really get very, very bad, and so I hope that rational minds are used to think this through and come up with solutions that work. And that is really key. And if that works, you know, then Trump will get all the credit from me for doing that, even if it costs all kinds of anxieties all around the globe. You know, this is something our trade deficit needs to be addressed, but it, you know, it needs to be addressed in a way that it doesn't ruin the economy for everybody. So we need to be really careful with that. So in terms of the economy right now, it's really strong. You know, the money is still cheap, and there is a surge. The surge in asset prices is working its way into other parts of the economy, and it's retail sales are strong. Consumer. And that's going to lead to the next discussion. Consumer borrowing has boomed, you know, right. So a lot of consumers are more confident, and they're borrowing more money to spend. And so retail sales are very strong. Inflation is up, and that's worrisome. So consumer price index is rising at close to 3% now and going and ticking higher. So it'll probably go over 3% pretty soon. And that's disconcerting because it hits the purchasing power of consumers. So in the long term, that's going to be a real problem. But right now, consumers are not feeling that. They still have access to their credit, and they're going pretty strong. So I don't see a recession or anything like that this year. Okay. I mean, maybe next year, maybe year after next. But right now, this year looks very solid. I mean, there would have to be some kind of major sudden event that would cause a recession. Now, right now, I mean, the second quarter looks good. The first quarter was good. I don't see any major hiccup this year. At the same time, you know, consumer borrowing has surged, and there's now over $1 trillion in auto loans out there. There's over $1 trillion in credit card loans out there. There's well over $1 trillion in student loans out there. I think consumer debt will hit $4 trillion combined. That's not counting mortgage debt. So just the non-housing debt will hit $4 trillion here in a couple of months, and that's a lot of money. And that is expensive debt, especially credit card debt is very expensive debt. And when you look at these numbers a little bit, one way to look at the debt burden is to compare it to disposable income. So this is income minus taxes. And so what's left over after taxes. And that ratio of required debt payments, so interest and principal payments compared to disposable income, that ratio is closely watched. And before the financial crisis, it was In the 90s, it was in the teens, you know, and then it ticked up to 20%. And then during the financial crisis, household income actually, disposable income plunged during the financial crisis. So it actually, that caused some problems, but also consumers defaulted on their debts, on their credit cards, on their car loans. And so they whittled down their debt that way, not really that they paid it off, but they just got, you know, they defaulted on and got rid of it that way. And now we're, we're at 27% roughly, and 26%, and the highest ever. And so that number, that 27% spread over all consumers. But you got to remember, there's about a third or more of the consumers who essentially don't have debt. They got their mortgages paid off, and they don't have debt on their credit cards. They pay them off every month, and they don't owe anything on student loans, and they pay cash for their cars. Yeah, and then we have a midsection of consumers that have moderate amounts of debt, and they're just fine. And then we have the most vulnerable consumers that make the least amount of money, and they have the most amount of debt, and it's all that expensive consumer debt. And that consumer debt is concentrated in that area of the most vulnerable. So that $4 trillion that is owed in non-housing debt is concentrated among the most vulnerable consumers. And those are the debt slaves. Those are the people that work very hard to pay the debts. They work very hard to just pay interest on their credit cards.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you got a credit card debt of $10,000 and you're paying 25% interest, you know, that's $2,500. Yeah, and then credit card debt can be more. It can be over 30%. Yeah. So suddenly you're talking about paying several thousand dollars of interest on food and clothing that you bought maybe years ago. And that, you know, they're gone, and what's left over is that debt. And they, because of that interest payment, they have trouble making ends meet, so they borrow more, and so the debt increases, and you get into the cycle, and then in the end they say, well, I can't do this anymore. And so now we have seen the default rates surge already. And as I said, you know, the economy is very strong right now, but credit card default rates have exploded to financial crisis levels, but only at the smaller banks. The largest banks, they've been cherry-picking the customers, you know, and they're trying to get the good customers with lots of money and good incomes, and they offer them 50,000 frequent flyer miles for signing up, and they give them all the great benefits, you know, and low interest rates, and these are customers that don't really need the credit cards to begin with, and so they may never have a debt on that, but they, you know, you use it to purchase stuff, and every time you purchase something with a credit card, the bank, it's a cut of the fees, you know, and so you may never have to borrow on the credit card for the bank to make money. The bank makes money off the transaction fees, and so they love that. And then the smaller banks that can't offer those kind of benefits, they went after what was left, which is a lot of subprime-ready customers and other vulnerable customers that are over-indebted, and they, you know, and they lent money to them or gave them credit cards with big credit limits. And now we have seen the default rate surge in that category to 8-9%, which is huge, you know. And now the economy is good. People have jobs, you know. I mean, there's some debate as to how good it is, because our, you know, employment numbers are probably not the best way to depict the labor market. But we've used the same employment numbers for all these years, and we've added a couple of million jobs a year, and people aren't getting laid off right now. You know, they have jobs. They have jobs, and they default on the credit cards. That's what's happening right now. The most vulnerable, and that is a real problem, because at some point we're going to get a recession, and people will lose their jobs.
Yeah.
And what, you know, and then it's the default rates by then will already be high.
Right.
And suddenly people lose their jobs, and then it, you know, during the financial crisis, people just started defaulting on the loans after they were losing their jobs. And, you know, almost 10 million people lost their jobs. I mean, that was terrible. And so right now the economy is good, and the credit card default rates are shooting up. So this is really not a good situation. And it shows that the debt slave, so the most vulnerable consumers, are getting in trouble. And that they can no longer play this game, you know, that the interest rates on these credit cards are too high. Banks got too greedy. Instead of charging 8%, you know, they're charging 28%. And in consumers, there's no way they can pay this off. You know, there's peer-to-peer lenders that are in that market. They do personal loans, and they have big default rates on this basis. And so the most vulnerable consumers, I think, are in trouble. Most of the debt slaves, and I'm worried about them. You know, this is we have a strong economy, and that part of the population is not doing well, and that's really tough.
That's a little bit scary. So, Wolf, what admonishment might you have for listeners? What can the average American out there that's working hard and doing their best, how can they protect themselves? What kind of last words, parting shot do you have for listeners?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest protection is to make sure your life is in order. So you do a job well, you take care of your family, you take care of your loved ones. I think that is crucial. You get through any kind of crisis if you got that part together, if you got your family and your friends together, you know, so that is really crucial. In terms of for young people, I'm a big proponent of learning. It doesn't have to be formal education. It can be a trade. It can be anything. But, once you learn something like that, it doesn't really matter what happens to the economy. If you have a trade that is in demand, or if a expertise that is in demand, you'll be okay. In terms of financial risk, I think we are surrounded by landmines. And it is very difficult these days to give financial advice because everything you tell people to buy is incredibly risky these days. And I don't give financial advice, so I really don't get into that. Thanks to the Fed's raising interest rates, there are short-term government bonds and savings accounts and CDs out there that return over 2%. It's still below the rate of inflation, but at least you won't lose your money. Yeah, these are secure investments. I think precious metals are always an option. I'm not a real fan right now of precious metals because the cycles are so long. I got caught with silver in 1982, and it took 20 years to work out. And so the down cycles are very long, and the up cycles are very long too. And I'm not sure we're deep enough into the down cycle to make precious metals a good buy. But, you know, if you own the physical, then it's good to have and enjoy having it and don't worry about it. And it's going to be there, you know, and just hang on to it. But the big thing right now, I think, for people with some wealth is capital preservation. You know, capital preservation is very hard to do when the boom stops because things fall apart left and right. You know, where do you put your money?
Yeah.
And I think capital preservation is an art that many people that made lots of money have not learned, and they will lose lots of money. So I think the next few years will be about capital preservation.
Wow. Amazing, Wolf. Wolf, do you have any final words for listeners? Anything out there that's kind of lingering? Anything else that you'd like listeners to know?
Well, enjoy the economy while it's good. It won't last forever, you know. I mean, make hay while the sun shines. And right now, you know, despite a lot of the negatives out there right now, the economy is pretty strong. So, don't think capital preservation and the economy is good. So,
well said. Wolf Richter, ladies and gentlemen, wolfstreet.com. Wolf, thanks for being you.
Thanks for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, incredible. Wow. Incredibly said. Now, this guy knows exactly what he's talking about. He knows the economy well. Okay? He's very well versed in what's happening. Again, I'll repeat it because it's noteworthy. Wolfstreet.com. gets about a million hits a month. And I don't know what kind of staff he's got, but whatever he's doing educates and informs. And hey, kind of like you said, consumer confidence. And so certainly you get consumer confidence going, you've got a good source to be confident about, and that would be Wolf Richter. I will be right back to close out this program. I'm your host, Ian Hamilton Trottier. You've tuned in to Discussions of Truth on Wynwood Radio. That guitar is amazing. I think that's Kurt Hammett. I'm not sure. Woo, that's wild. Wild. Metallica, amazing. Wolf Richter.
Oh my gosh. Like, what incredible fortune. Discussions of Truth. Formerly, by the way, I started this almost 2 years ago. Formerly, by the way, the Florida Sun and Spray Show. If you don't know that history, it's the Zika virus that came ashore in Miami Beach and Wynwood, where I broadcast out of, and the pesticide that was sprayed for that virus called Nalid. It just so happens that Nalid was engineered in the 1950s by Chevron Chemical Corporation in a town called Walnut Creek, California, basically a few miles away from San Francisco. And Nalid, Zika, if you haven't heard about it, it certainly comes from the Uganda forest of Africa. But what kind of piqued my interest in this? And by the way, somebody asked me to come on to this. I was invited to start this. That's really how that started. I wasn't looking to start a radio program. But what piqued my interest was the Zika virus. The scientists that were funded to study that were Rockefeller Foundation funded. And the company that engineered the pesticide, Nalid, also known as Dibron, that's another trade name, they have maybe four trade names, was a Chevron Chemical Corporation. The largest shareholders of Chevron Chemical Corporation would be the Rockefeller Foundation as well. See, when Standard Oil was split up under the antitrust, those seven companies that it split up into, the Rockefellers retained majority ownership of all seven companies. I leave that with you. Next week, we bring on Robert Bridge. It'll be 4th of July. He's a former editor-in-chief of Moscow News, the Moscow News. And he's going to discuss his current book, Midnight in the American Empire. Corporate America is no longer content doing what it does best. Yeah, Wolf was just talking about us about the greedy corporate American companies, right? Yeah, go to the lowest manufacturing price point. Where is it? Mexico? No longer Mexico, we go to China. So, corporate America is no longer content doing what it does best, which is making money. These business behemoths are aggressively attempting to control the entire economy, cultural, and political realm of American life. Debt slaves comes to my mind. Debt slaves. Wolf just said it. Don't be a debt slave. They have nearly succeeded, Robert continues. Most Americans would agree that corporate power should be prohibited from disrupting the natural rhythm of our democratic institutions. Yet we the people are thwarted from addressing the subject of corporate power, not because we do not wish to have the conversation, but because we have nobody to address the issue. Our political representatives, hostages as they are to corporate campaign donations and government lobbyists, cannot seriously debate the question of corporate power. Indeed, their very careers depend on corporate power. Meanwhile, the media, the so-called fourth estate, Robert says, refuses to discuss the issue of excessive corporate power because the media itself is a corporation. At the same time, the consequences of excessive corporate power are becoming acutely obvious inside of the corporate universe. Today, fewer U.S. workers are spending more time on the job to produce a greater amount of products while not receiving fair recompense. Debt slave. Meanwhile, wages for American workers adjusted for inflation have remained stagnant for the past 30 years, while U.S. vacation time in the United States is the lowest of all the industry's industrial economies. The blatant lack of representation in the workplace is directly responsible for these shameful statistics. Just 7% of the American workforce today enjoys union representation, a percentage that pales in comparison with past generations. There's also the question of corporations disrupting the fabric of cultural life. Indeed, today, Main Street USA is largely unrecognizable. This can be witnessed in everything from preponderance of fast food restaurants and hyper stores, I'm assuming Walmarts, to corporate America's aggressive monopoly on all forms of entertainment. So, there we have it. Fine. I'm going to continue. Entertainment, which is on a downward spiral to total degeneracy. Wow. Wake up, America. Yes, your entertainment is degenerate. I totally agree. Well, most of it. Since corporate-owned cultural revenues, i.e. television, film, books, have more influence over our children than do educational institutions, Robert continues, it should come as no surprise that violence and unsocial behavior is on the rise. And I don't have seen recent statistics, but it's hard to argue with that. History has always proven that no nation can survive for long once its moral fabric has been shredded. Finally, the symptoms of extreme levels of corporate power in our lives are becoming increasingly conspicuous in a variety of ways. From the rise of a destructive, I'm not reading the whole book, by the way, I'm just reading a Google review. From the rise of destructive behavior at home to the sadistic treatment prisoners of war, i.e. John Kiriakou, right? In Four Lands, Guantanamo Bay, to the reckless disregard for, he's been a guest on my show two times, by the way. Go into my archive, iantrottier.com. I urge you to do that, please. For the collapse of the natural environment, something has gone awry in the heart of America, Robert says. I call it corporate zombieism. The nature of the problem suggests that the American psyche is being guided and influenced by the less than respectable influences, since it is corporate America that is largely responsible for the degraded mental and physical content that are now feeding the people. The institution must accept a large part of the blame for America's fall from grace. The time has come to tame this beast of burden. The time has come to remove corporate power from the halls of power. It is time for the American people, like their proud and independent ancestors who founded this country many years ago, to regain control of their country once again. Happy 4th of July, Robert Bridge. He'll be on this program next week, July 4th, to celebrate Uncle Sam and your relationship with him. Because do not forget, you are the government. Ian Trottier. .com. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Facebook. Have a great day. You tuned into Wynnewood Radio. This is Discussions of Truth, coming your way every Wednesday at 5 o'clock. Be awesome.
Reliable and affordable cloud business communications and collaboration solution. You get high definition voice, video and audio conferencing,